This is an ABC podcast.
Good morning and welcome to Saturday AM. I'm Linda Mottram. Today on the program, can we be the clever country with thousands of research jobs on the chopping block?
That landscape for finding that permanent job has now become extremely bleak, if not evaporated altogether. And so it's just that uncertainty is just really, really stressful, and that sense that, you know, all that hard work has potentially gone to waste.
But first, Australia's relationship with China hit new lows this week, putting national security at odds with the economy.
What I'm really concerned about is this potential for a trade war to erupt and to damage Queensland's exports, to damage Queensland's reputation, and to damage Queensland's jobs and livelihoods.
China is threatening to put steep tariffs on Australian barley and has suspended beef imports from four major abattoirs, leaving farmers stuck in the middle of a political dispute.
We are at a halt. We've still got the buyers out there, but we can't process at the moment until all of this gets solved.
That's Karen Penfold. Her family owns the Queensland beef company Four Daughters, which exports to Wuhan. She normally sends 150 cattle a month to Northern Cooperative Meat Company in New South Wales, one of the four meatworks affected by the suspension. Now she's having to look for other options.
We're reinventing ourselves every day. We have been trying to speak to different processing facilities to see if they're prepared to take us on. We're just investigating everything we can do. We are just at the whim of what is going on in the world, really.
What's the prospect of being able to sell your beef domestically if the Chinese market was to not be there?
We have started that, but literally trying to do a direct from our farm gate, and that itself has been incredibly difficult, but we're not quitting. We've come up with a way of just trying to do domestic pink boxes, but we're having to then find a new supply chain that's prepared to work with us to develop a whole new product to actually get our beef direct to families. So we're trying. We're really now looking at, how can we build our domestic? And also, can we try to find other options of still continuing export and looking for different markets? Look, the phone's been ringing hot. We've had some, a couple of companies interested from Vietnam, and we'll just keep trying to find solutions to problems. I think that's what we all do well in Australia, and we just have to keep going.
Karen Penfold, who owns the Four Daughters beef brand in Queensland. Well, that trade row comes as Canberra pushes for an inquiry into the origins of coronavirus, which it will pursue at the World Health Assembly in Geneva next week. So what does that mean for our relationship with Beijing? Well, joining me are Peter Jennings, Executive Director of the Australian Strategic Policy Institute, which is funded partly by the Department of Defence, and James Lawrenson, who heads the Australia-China Relations Institute, which was established with funding from Chinese billionaire Huang Zhengmo. Thanks, both of you, for joining us. Let's start with the immediate trade issue we have with China at this moment. Peter, how serious do you think China is about inflicting economic damage on Australia?
I think they're serious about talking about inflicting economic damage, Linda. That's a slightly different thing. Really, what they're most keen on is to try to produce a shift in Australian political behaviour. And I think their first interest is to stop the government talking about holding an open and transparent investigation into the origins of the coronavirus. Whether or not that translates into real economic penalties, markets being cut off, I just don't know. What I think is very clear at this point is that it's really designed to serve a Chinese political objective rather than an economic one.
James, to you, will Beijing tolerate this continued push by Canberra for the investigation it wants into the origins of the coronavirus? Are we about to get a major trade war?
No, I don't think we are. Beijing trades with us mostly because it's in their interest to do so. And look, the reality is the Australian government is not going to bend to these sorts of threats. It's not in our interest to. If we do that, we only invite future economic coercion And then the relationship descends into one of subservience rather than one of mutual benefits. All that said, let's not lose sight of the bigger picture. We've had Beijing threatening barley and beef. But look, 80% of our beef going to China is still going to China as normal. And we've got $150 billion of trade exports going there as well. So this at the moment is very contained. It's very targeted. And I don't think we should be catastrophizing about it.
Peter, China is by far our biggest trading partner. Is it possible for the government to so openly pursue this investigation, something as incendiary as it is to China, without risking an escalation on the trade front?
Well, that really comes down not to the behaviour of the Australian government, but to the Chinese government. And, you know, what we've seen the Communist Party do is decide that it is just going to take an extremely assertive and uncooperative approach to any country wanting to talk about the origins of the virus. I think this is really damaging to China in the long run. I don't think the rest of the world is really going to bow to the narrative that the Communist Party wants to create for this. And in a world where you've got, you know, something well over a quarter of a million people dead and the global economy thrust into a deep depression, of course countries are going to want to understand how that happened. I think if China is going to persist in this very assertive sort of our way or the highway type of approach, they will ultimately force a whole range of countries that would probably rather avoid it into taking, you know, much more confrontational positions with regard to China.
I guess the confluence of this is going to come forward next week at the World Health Assembly meeting in Geneva. And a lot of countries are pursuing this issue of an investigation. And obviously it's routine for the WHO to do such a thing anyway in such a crisis. James, how do you think China is going to respond to that? Because clearly next week in Geneva, it's going to be very evident that China can't just keep pushing back on this question.
Yeah, look, I think China's response has been exaggerated and uncalled for. What you can see they're most worried about is Australia lining up with the United States on this one. Now, I don't think that's fair. I don't think it's accurate. But that's clearly the way some in Beijing are reading it. And we've got to be careful here. I mean, there's absolutely nothing wrong with the Australian government's approach in insisting on an inquiry. It's what the Australian people and many people around the world would expect. But we certainly do want to keep a bit of a healthy distance from Washington on this one. I mean, we do have President Trump labelling this the Chinese virus. We've got Mike Pompeo, the Secretary of State, openly spreading conspiracy theories. So let's not be naive. There's a broader geopolitical backdrop here of a massive spat between China and the United States. And frankly, I don't think either of those countries are going to come out of COVID-19 looking very good.
Peter, let me come back to you then. In the last couple of weeks, we've heard a lot of talk about, you know, is Australia too reliant on China? The pandemic has really sort of brought this into focus. Is this an obvious moment, do you think, when Australia is going to rethink its dependence on China?
Absolutely. You can see that happening already. I think this really has been a moment when the penny has dropped for government and opposition and for a lot of other parties as well. And to the extent that we can, and I don't underestimate how difficult this is going to be, I think the challenge for our economy is to see how far can we diversify where we have to in order to reduce this overall level of dependence on China. It's not bad to sell them stuff. I mean, for as long as we can do it, I guess we should try to. But what is, I think, intolerable from an Australian perspective is that China weaponizes economic interaction as a way of trying to shape political behavior. So we give ourselves a bit more of an opportunity to think in our own way and to address our own national security interests if we can spread the economic risk and diversify our exports. Now, you know, I'm sure James is going to tell us about how difficult that is. But I think in truth, the reality is over the last 20 years or so, we've had, frankly, a pretty easy and lazy run of it, turning ourselves into a one-trick pony that's interested in selling stuff only to one easy market. And so we are the authors of our own problem, not so much China. Now what we need to do is the much harder task of diversifying. And I've no doubt that there'll be many industry sectors which will squeal extremely unhappily about that. But the price is the protection of our national security.
James, Peter mentioned that you might have views on how difficult it is to diversify. Do you think we need to diversify, first of all?
I think you are going to see some diversification happening quite naturally. So I think one thing national security commentators often miss is that businesses are alive to risk. It's their money on the line, after all. Now, Australian companies with major international operations, they monitor a series of risks, political risk amongst them. And I think China's really shot itself in the foot here because I think it's over its own actions over the past week. There'll be a lot of Australian companies who will be reassessing their political risk in their exposure to China. So you'll get some diversification through that. And I think that's fine. What we don't want to be doing is shooting ourselves in the foot in response. I'd be very concerned if the Australian government started forcing Australian companies to diversify away from China. I mean, I work in the university sector. And look, it's just not true to say that we haven't tried to diversify our international student base. But the reality is that there's not a lot of other alternatives out there. Look, here's a pretty devastating statistic. Over the last decade, the annual value of Australia's exports has gone up by $180 billion. That's a great story for the national interest. There's a lot of jobs there. But in the end, only one country has supplied 60% of the jump. That's China. India, Indonesia, Japan, the US, they're just not as interested in Australian goods and services as China is.
Peter, can I come back to you on that? I've heard from the trade minister on a number of occasions saying, look, the reason we're doing trade deals with countries like India, Indonesia, Peru, is that, you know, we're signalling to companies, to businesses in Australia, there are opportunities elsewhere, but there is nothing the size of China. Even India, I mean, it'll be years before India can match that market. That's the harsh reality here, isn't it?
It's true. I mean, there is nothing the size of the Chinese economy. That's undeniable, which means to say that I think we have to start thinking about how we cater to multiple markets rather than simply just one. You know, if China was a different country, if China was turning into Singapore, there would be no problem here because that would be a China which could accept that Australia would advance its own strategic interests. And it wouldn't be using trade as a weapon to try to force us into changing our political behaviour. But that's not the China that we've got. We have a China which is actually becoming more authoritarian and seemingly now taking the view that it can sort of export that type of demand and expectation of countries being servile to its interests. I accept all of the points that James makes about the size of the market, the difficulty of diversifying. But nevertheless, we are going to be thrust down this path, not because we want to, but because China will ultimately force us to. So that's the dilemma. And absolutely, governments should not be shooting themselves in the foot by saying and doing things that they don't have to. But increasingly, Beijing's expectations of what they think smaller and dependent countries should do is just going to conflict with how we will behave.
James, it is the case, isn't it, that the Chinese Communist Party's you know, re-emergence as really the central dominant authority under Xi Jinping's leadership has really changed the trajectory, hasn't it? And that's what we're seeing, is this incredible assertiveness and throwing around of weight. That really does challenge us, doesn't it, in security terms as well as economic terms.
Oh, it does. I mean, Peter clearly and correctly draws attention to the fact that under Xi Jinping, China has changed. It has. When you look at its behaviour, it has changed. You look at what it's doing domestically in Xinjiang, for example, locking up hundreds of thousands of its own citizens in re-education camps. You look in the South China Sea, where it disregards international law. So this is the reality, and I think we do have to respond to it. I guess my point, though, is I think the Australian government is actually doing a pretty good job here. We've been on the front foot. We've called out China's actions in Xinjiang. We've called out China's actions in the South China Sea. And we should keep doing that. There is another big issue here, though, Linda, and that is China's not the same as the United States. That's absolutely true. China's a harder actor to deal with. But our security ally here isn't helping at all. I mean, the United States is openly weaponizing trade as well, threatening Australian interests. At the end of last year, it blew up the dispute resolution body attached to the World Trade Organization. Now, that's the rules-based order under attack that a country like Australia relies on to protect its interests. So we certainly can't be naive about China, but I think we need to face up to a bit of a reality here that the United States has changed as well, and we might need to start pushing back against them too.
James Lawrenson is Acting Director of the Australia-China Relations Institute, and Peter Jennings is Executive Director of the Australian Strategic Policy Institute. As universities across the country grapple with the loss of revenue thanks to compulsory border shutdowns, there are growing concerns about the future of Australian research. There are estimates that as many as 7,000 research-related jobs could be lost in our universities. And with funding in limbo, much of the country's research workforce has placed its existing work on hold or switched to COVID-19-focused projects. Darren Saunders is a cancer biologist and associate professor in medicine at the University of New South Wales, where he heads the Ubiquitin Signalling Lab. But for the moment, he, like so many of us, is working from home.
Yeah, for those of us not doing immunology and vaccine development and testing development, most of our work, not all of it, but most of it is ground to a halt. You know, we're on that sort of shutdown type system where we're only supposed to be going into work for very essential things, and we've got to maintain very strict rules about that. And so we've been asked not to do any sort of new experiments or do any sort of lab work that's not essential. So we're restricted to data analysis at our benches, basically.
You personally work in medical research, which also relies quite heavily on philanthropic donations. So is there a double whammy here, less funding for unis and fewer donations?
Yeah, there really is. So, I mean, we've already been going through a funding squeeze for a number of years now, where it's getting harder and harder to get funding. And then that gives us a greater reliance on philanthropic funding. And now with the funding squeeze that's being applied to universities on top of that, and with what's happening to the business community and to everybody else, you know, losing income and things, it's going to be even harder to get hold of that supplementary funding that we rely on from the various charities and foundations.
Now, the Rapid Research Information Forum, it's convened by Australia's chief scientist. They've written to the federal government expressing concern about research. They're projecting university job losses of 21,000 full-time positions, and they say 7,000 could be research-related academic staff. So what impact do you think that would, those kinds of job losses would have on Australian research?
Oh, well, it would gut the system. You know, our system's not that big to start with, and to where that level of losses would be absolutely devastating. It would be catastrophic, I would say, actually, and really set us back, probably a decade. I mean, you know, you can't just turn research on and off like a tap. It's something that you need to build capacity slowly, and not just research infrastructure, but human capacity and the knowledge and training that goes with that. And to just gut it, as appears likely to happen, is really going to set us back a long way. And, you know, people are still getting sick from the diseases that we work on that aren't COVID. And so it's going to have a huge effect playing out over a really long period of time.
And is there an equity issue around who's likely to be more affected among the research community?
Yeah, I think that's a really important point. The people most likely to be affected are the more junior people, those that, I mean, I don't think a lot of people realise that a lot of the people that are actually in the lab at the bench doing research are very junior. They're postgraduate students, they're recently graduated postdoctoral students and research assistants. Most of them are on very short-term contracts, and they are likely to be most heavily affected. And then the other thing that we're already seeing evidence of, in fact, is that, for example, women researchers are going to be more heavily affected. We've already seen at scientific journals that there are fewer manuscripts being submitted from women researchers at the moment, and we think that's probably because they're bearing the brunt of having to look after kids at home and among other things. And so there really is a really great potential that we can set back some of the minor gains that we've started to make on equity back to, you know, probably back a few years at least.
Well, Frances Flanagan is one of those early career researchers on a shorter term contract. She's currently teaching and working on research into work and organisational studies at Sydney University.
So before the downturn, I'd been working really hard on a portfolio of publications and teaching experience, and I was hoping to go on the market for a permanent job in about 18 months' time. That moment really was the culmination of about, you know, 10 years of preparation. And now the spectre of long-term job losses, redundancies, people being stood down, that landscape for finding that permanent job has now become extremely bleak, if not evaporated altogether. And so it's just that uncertainty is just really, really stressful, and that sense that, you know, all that hard work has potentially gone to waste, and just the great disappointment at not being able to, you know, do that job that I've wanted for so long that, you know, is in service to the public interest.
That is an extraordinarily long timeline. Are you now thinking in the future you're going to have to potentially completely change your career plans?
Well, I'm pretty fortunate in the sense that I've had periods working outside academia as well as within academia. So that is a you know, a possibility. And, you know, I do feel fortunate that I have other potential options to return to. But I particularly feel, I suppose, for those early career researchers where this is all that they've done, and they were expecting this career trajectory that was just going to go up and up and really contribute to that high quality research that Australia is famous for, and then they'll have to just start again in a completely different sector. And that's such an incredible waste of talent and energy and research.
Sydney University academic Francis Flanagan there. Now back to Darren Saunders, because he says there's another issue affecting our research capacity, and that's the lack of international students currently in the country.
So on top of the hit of, you know, the funding problem that's going to happen, a lot of our graduate students, the people doing the research, are international students, and a lot of them aren't able to get into the country at the moment. Those that are here are under pretty severe stress from being isolated from their families and even in some cases financial stress. So the double whammy effect will be that not only are we going to lose a lot of people, we're also going to have people that can't come back in to finish their projects for quite some time, and there'll be probably pretty significant delays there. So we're really sort of getting whacked from a bunch of different directions at the moment, you know.
So in an ideal world, what would you like to see from government to help solve this problem?
Well, you know, I mean, the obvious answer to that is always put some money into it. I mean, you know, we're in the middle of a public health and medical crisis, and it seems like a sort of an insane time to be gutting our research capacity. But really what it points to is a sort of a lack of policy, or a policy failing over a really long period of time. You know, we've seen this slow erosion of research funding, university funding, and also, you know, research being carried out in private industry is also, you know, quite low on world standards in Australia. And so that points to probably some attitudinal issues, but it also points to probably a long-term policy failure. So I think what we'd really like to see is some long-term sector-wide strategy put in place that we can sort of do some planning around and have some confidence that we can approach this with a sort of mid to long-term goal in mind, rather than sort of existing on year-to-year drip feeding of contracts and funding.
That's Darren Saunders. He's a cancer biologist and associate professor in medicine at the University of New South Wales. Well, in the US, the unemployment rate has hit 14.7%, the highest rate since the Great Depression. Last month alone, a staggering 20.5 million jobs vanished from the economy, the worst monthly loss on record. This week, some of those who have lost their jobs descended on Washington. These bus drivers want more support from the administration.
They have helped out the airlines and the cruise ships, but they forgot us.
Not looking for handouts, just more help to help us survive, to be there for our country when the time comes and we begin to get back rolling again.
And as the US government looks at ways to restart the economy, there's also a looming presidential election. Americans will cast their ballots in November, and there are lots of questions about what the race to the White House will look like this year. David Lipson is the ABC's Washington Bureau Chief. I asked him what the crisis has done for Donald Trump's chances in this election.
That is the million-dollar question. It's hard to know is the answer. What we see is that a majority of Americans believe that he has done a poor job. They're dissatisfied with his handling of the coronavirus crisis. But in terms of his support, well, it hasn't slipped much below that 42% core support that he has had throughout his presidency. So that means that his core supporters, it seems, according to the polls, are sticking by him. What is worrying for Donald Trump and those around him is that there seems to be a slipping away of a very important element of Republican voters, and that is older Americans. They seem to be pretty unhappy with the way that Donald Trump has handled this health crisis. And we have seen that occurring in some of the battleground states. So there have been numerous reports in the past week or so about unnamed Republicans being very worried about their Senate seats, for example. If that continues, you may start to see senators in the Republican Party breaking out and distancing themselves publicly from Donald Trump if they think it's going to work for them. But, you know, there are polls and there are polls. We saw another poll this week out by CNN that suggested that, in fact, Donald Trump held a lead over Joe Biden in all of the states that mattered, the battleground states. Again, it's very hard to tell, particularly with the electoral college system that we have here in the US.
Donald Trump has always campaigned hard on the economy. That's difficult to do when you've got 30 million people out of work. He seems to be dealing with that with the usual bluster.
I think we're going to have a tremendous fourth quarter. I think we're going to have a transitional third quarter. And I think we're going to have a phenomenal next year.
So, David, do many voters share Trump's optimism there?
Well, you know, the stock market is back to levels that we saw late last year. So that is quite extraordinary. Certainly, Donald Trump, it seems, is not too keen to campaign fully on the economy either. I mean, he has fallen back on some of his other campaign methods, that is blaming his opponents, attacking them, attacking China, attacking anyone else within his orbit, and accusing his Democratic opponents, Joe Biden in particular, for being too soft on China in the past.
Now, speaking of Joe Biden, he hasn't really had to do very much at all. What has he had to say on his digital campaign trail?
It's been an unusual campaign for Joe Biden, to say the least. He is basically locked down in his basement at home. He's got a temporary studio running from there. But he has all but disappeared from the media arena, which is incredibly unusual at this point in the election cycle. He's really struggling to get any oxygen. He's trying pretty hard. But, you know, he is probably going to struggle somewhat in the digital space. Donald Trump is very effective on Twitter. Not everyone likes his tweets, but everyone reads them, and they do always have an impact. Joe Biden, on the other hand, well, he is trying to run a campaign on sort of good governance and anyone but Trump. But as I say, at this point in the cycle, he's not getting a lot of oxygen.
Now, you mentioned that Donald Trump and the Republicans have gone into attack mode. Another element of that has been an attack on the Russia investigation. Remember that. He's branding it Obamagate. What's he accusing the Democrats of?
This is pretty complex. It goes all the way back to 8 days before the Obama administration handed over to Donald Trump. And at that time, there were concerns in Obama's team that someone on the Trump team had been liaising with Russia before they were legally allowed to do so. So they asked the intelligence services to unmask the person, and it turned out to be Michael Flynn, the national security advisor, who would soon be appointed to Donald Trump's administration and would then be fairly promptly fired once that all came to light. Now, he was charged with lying to the FBI. That all fed into the Russia investigation. But in the last couple of weeks, the Department of Justice has decided to advise that prosecutors drop their prosecution case against Michael Flynn. So he has been released from all sort of charges against him. And now the Trump administration is trying to turn it back on Barack Obama by declassifying the people within Obama's administration who unmasked Michael Flynn in the first place. So that's how they've come up with this claim of Obamagate. They are trying to point out that this was very strange behavior for an outgoing administration to be going after soon to be appointed a national security advisor of the next administration. And importantly, and this is perhaps what it all comes down to, one of the people in Obama's team who is you know, suspected of maybe ordering that unmasking, we don't know for sure, but he's among the suspects, is Joe Biden.
So it's the first Tuesday in November when Americans go to the polls. We've heard senior health figures in the US this week warning that there could be a terrible autumn ahead for the United States because the coronavirus is still not controlled. That still looms large for Trump, doesn't it, looking forward to November?
It does in a big way, and it will matter, and particularly among those older voters if they're starting to get sick again. The other reason that this matters is whether people are going to be willing to vote. And as such, there is a huge push at the moment, particularly by the Democrats, to organise for mail-in ballots or universal mail-in ballots. Now, the Republican Party feel that they would be disadvantaged by this. And Donald Trump said that outright. If we were to move to mail-in votes, the Republicans would never win another election. So this will be a big fight going forward and a very important one too. That is, how will this election actually take place? Because how that's decided could actually determine, particularly if it's a close election, who becomes the president after November.
David Lipson, very good to have your analysis. Thank you so much for your time today.
Thanks, Linda.
Well, that's Saturday AM for this week. Find us on the ABC Listen app or wherever you get your podcasts. And for news every 15 minutes across the weekend, head to ABC News Radio. I'm Linda Mottram. Talk to you next Saturday.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.